Okay, folks, you are listening to Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for tuning in, switching on, or filling your ears with the learnings of myself, Mike Parry, the Porkmeister. And I have to say that as we do another Planet Porky, I want to thank you all for the support that that we're getting here in putting these together. You know, we love doing them, and we love the responses. Any response you want, please, I'd love to hear from you. The address to get back to me, and I do want your responses. I don't care whether they're critical or whether they're praiseworthy. I'd love to know how you're feeling about it all. And it's planetporkypod@gmail.com, OK? planetporkypod@gmail.com. Send me any sort of response you want, because I'd really love to hear from you. And then we can, you know, get sorted as to whether what you're listening to is to your satisfaction, and what I'm saying is to mine. Okay, folks, now I want to tell you about The Economist. The Economist magazine. You might think it's only about economics, but it's not. It's about finance, it's about business, but it covers a range of subjects from world politics and business to science, technology, art, environment, and you know one of the favourite sections I like? The book reviews, okay? Because when somebody from The Economist reads a book and tells you all about it, believe me, you know about it, okay? Now, it sifts through the noise, in my opinion. It focuses on the essential information that tells the real story in a time when facts matter more than ever in this turbulent world we live in, both at home and away, okay? It's true to say The Economist has been a trusted source of intelligence for over 170 years. Yes, that's what I said, over 170 years. And it's for the kind of person, you, the reader, who never stops asking those questions and wants to know why the world is the way it is. I love an article in this week's Economist, and it's all about the fact that to make your brain go faster or to give you great ideas, doctors are actually considering zapping the skull. Yes, that's right. Oof, you know, a quick shock like that shakes up the brain. All of a sudden, you become a genius and you can write poetry and music. At least that's the theory. Now, The Economist is the smart guide to the forces impacting on your world. So if you've never stopped asking questions, in my opinion, you should take up this offer to get a free print copy right now, okay? This is what's on offer, a free print copy of The Economist. For that free print copy, just text PLANET to 78070. Let me please repeat that. I do not want you to miss this unmissable offer. For your free print copy of The Economist, just text PLANET to 78070. Oh. So anyway, listen, folks, I'm delighted to be able to say that this particular edition of Planet Porky is going to take a rest from the series that we've developed over the last three. And the series we developed over the last three was The Search for the First Mrs. Parry. You've had tales of my early romantic liaisons and why that never turned out to be or to end up in matrimony or a full-time relationship. We'll get back to The Search for the First Mrs. Parry in subsequent podcasts at Planet Porky. But for the moment, because so many of you have sent me questions, and I wasn't asking for them to start off with, and want to know how I can respond and help your lives, we're going to have a whole episode here of Ask Planet Porky. Now, I'll just open up my journal here, where fortunately one of my great assistants has run off a lot of the questions that you've given to me. We'll start with this one here. This has come off my my laptop. It's not my laptop, actually. It's what do you call it? A tab. I'm not very good at this, but anyway, I've got it here. Somebody's just found it for me. Here we go. So this comes from a guy called Steve. And Steve, I want to say thank you very much indeed. The question is this. Dear Porky, it's fantastic to have you back again. Brilliant to be on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed, Steve. That's great. Now, he says, myself and three friends go away for a long weekend every autumn to a European city to watch a football match and partake in some light bladderization. Okay, well, light bladderization is good. You've got to remember the motive by which I lead my life, folks, is blado in modo. Okay, blado in modo is a very good thing. It means bladderation in moderation, and then nobody gets into any sort of trouble. Okay. Anyway, to go on, Steve goes on. We're having some difficulty in choosing a location for our next trip. We've already been to Madrid, Frankfurt, Lisbon, Dusseldorf and Lyon. What places have you visited on your travels where we could get the best mix of culture and blado in modo? Just to bring that expression up again. Thank you. And once again, he says, lovely to hear you again, enjoying the podcast. Not trying to blow my own trumpet, but that's what I'm going to hear from you folks. And equally, if you want to say, look, you know, I can't get my head around these, let me know, because I want you not only to get your head around them, but to get your ears around them as well, OK? So, to answer Stephen's question, thank you very much indeed, Steve. Naturally, as I've spent the last 20 years as a... you know, as a broadcaster and travelling sort of broadcaster and reporter for Talk Sport, which is the biggest sports news station in the world, sports station, but news as well. I've been to a lot of places where I've been to a lot of football matches, you know. South Africa, Germany, well, everywhere, really, everywhere in Europe, South Africa, Turkey, South America, and... you know, there's a 100 stories I could tell, which we'll tell another day. But I want to answer the question here for Steve. I'm assuming that he's talking about Europe, really, because, you know, travelling is extensive, you go long ways and all that. But he's going with a group of mates, four of them. They sound to me like they're going to be very well behaved and all this. Now, the football match thing is different from just going away, if you understand what I'm saying. Because when you go for a weekend for a football match, you know it's going to be packed. You know it's going to be absolutely crowded. And you know that you're going to have to be under peer pressure to, you know, take a lot of drink. And you'll have to cope with facilities which are going to be under demand and therefore pressurised and therefore maybe not that comfortable. So my first suggestion to Steve is to do it on a non-football weekend, OK? Some of the football trips I've taken, I mean, so memorable, but, you know, places like Latvia, beautiful, but much better without football fans there. Riga, I'm talking about, the capital, you know, rebuilt really by the Germans, funnily enough, over the last sort of 20 years, because they're not far away, are they? It's the one of the Baltic nations. Glorious places I've been to, Tel Aviv, but again, a football match would have been better without a football match. Istanbul, famous football matches there, obviously, the Liverpool victory. I wasn't at that one, but I went to see England play an international there. Would have been better without a football match. You know, all the countries, all the cities in Germany and Europe, you know, Paris and Madrid and Bonn and Frankfurt and Munich and Brussels and, you know, Switzerland and Austria, Zurich, they're better cities without a football match. So what I'm saying is, Steve, I wouldn't worry too much about the football match itself. I would go with your mates for a cultural diversion and leave the football match behind. So that means going out of season. Now, the problem with going out of season, of course, is it gets pretty packed. So why don't you go in season? Because I prefer travelling certainly in autumn and winter rather than spring and summer. And you could go, for instance, to a great European country maybe during the international break. So what you're doing there is you're deliberately not going to see a football match. You're going to a great city where there definitely won't be any football because of the international break, and you and your mates can then fill your heads with culture, spend a bit more time thinking about what you want to do, travelling around the city, and you won't be regimented into doing the things that football fans do when they go abroad together. Now, if you want my suggestion for cities, the problem is I like to go far and wide, so I haven't been to watch a football match in Iceland, but I've been there because I wanted to go to Iceland, see what it was like. Everton played there in 1970 against Keflavik, the second city team to Reykjavik when we were in the European Cup after winning the league in 1970. I was too young to go in those days, but I've been since and been to the ground where they played. I loved Iceland. I've been to Amsterdam quite a few times. And the reason I mention Reykjavik and Amsterdam is because they're two tourist spots in Europe where, no joke, the people who run them, people who run Amsterdam, the people who run Iceland, are now having to think about curtailing visitor numbers. So what I'm saying here is, Steve, you better get busy on organising one of these weekend things, because there is a growing trend within Europe to stop visitors coming, because they're not destroying cities, but they are ruining cities for the people who live there. This has happened in other places in the world. Machu Picchu, or is it Machu Pinchu or Manchu Picchu, which is the place in Peru, isn't it, where all the Aztecs used to live and all that. I mean, they're having to turn people away now because so many people have gone there. I've already said in a previous podcast that the situation on Everest is ridiculous because so many people are going up Everest now. There's a three-hour wait to get from, you know, sort of a reasonably high point until you get to the summit, and people are dying of frostbite and cold because it's minus 25 degrees. So the problem is the world's getting too accessible to everybody. So my final word on this one, Steve, is don't go on a football weekend. Don't go anywhere that's terribly popular. And even, you know, Iceland is popular these days. I would use a bit of brain power, you and your mates, get together over a few beers one night, open a map of Europe, because quite honestly, I think it's not going to be a weekend if you've got to go much further than that. And find yourself somewhere nobody else has been before. And I mean that. There are great, great cities all over Europe. In France, in Spain, in Belgium, in Holland, obviously, in Scandinavia. And find yourself somewhere new. And then when you come back, with all the pictures you can take these days on your phones and all that, you will actually have something to tell somebody. And you'll have been somewhere that nobody else has been, OK? So that's my answer to that one. Rather long-winded, I'm sorry, but I am trying to help, OK? This is all Ask Porky, and I'm going to help you out, okay? So let's whiz through a few more and get them done rather more quickly. Right. Okay, Adam has sent me a note saying, Porky, what is your favourite meal to cook apart from fish fingers? Well, I mean, my fish finger pyramid is legendary. The other things that I've done in the past and I've done on put out videos of them, pork pies. I love cooking pork pies. And you say, well, that doesn't take much. Well, it's not just heating them up in the oven, you know. You've got to do them properly and serve them with tomato sauce, Heinz tomato sauce, obviously. Tomato ketchup, and very fresh white bloomer bread with butter on it, OK? It's the way to do it. A bit of pepper. But to ask what is my favourite meal to cook, it is the traditional British roast. Now, I was brought up in the north of England, in Chester, and every Sunday as a kid, my mum cooked the Sunday roast. And I think it rotated between sort of beef and lamb, and at Christmas, turkey. Sometimes I think we had chicken, but basically we were a beef and Yorkshire pudding or roast, lamb and mint sauce family, and it was just beautiful. It came with, mushy peas, which my mum used to soak overnight, Saturday to Sunday, because she wouldn't take anything out of a can. It came out of a packet hard and soaked them till they got soft. Turnips and swede, I remember we used to have. Carrots, green cabbage, you can't seem to get sort of dark green cabbage these days. Cauliflower. I mean, it was just the most beautiful meal in the world. And if I was on my deathbed and somebody said, you've got an hour to live, what's your last meal? Or if I was about to be shot, you know, after some incursion and I'd got on the wrong side of things, I'd say I want one of my mum's roast dinners. Now, in saying that, of course, I can cook a roast dinner, but it never tastes the same as my mum. I don't know why. I think it's because, obviously, there's a great skill and a great art. Both my sisters, by the way, cook great roast dinners, and I see them as often as I can. Traditionally, Sunday is the day to eat the roast dinner. And I do love the roast. And what they can do that I can't do is they can coordinate the different parts of the roast dinner and get them all on the plate at the same time and have the gravy in a bowl on the table so you can serve yourself. And the roast potatoes are just sort of beautifully done and as crisp as you want them, but not over crisp, and as soft as you want them, but not over soft. And if you see what I mean, it all comes together. So it's honestly like putting a jigsaw together. And I think the advantage they've got is often when I'm eating a roast dinner at one of my sister's houses, the other will be there. So they've got an advantage over me in that they're both working on the roast dinner at the same time, and therefore it comes out looking great and tasting great. And so I would opt for that one, OK? Now then, another one here. This is from somebody called Anthony. Mike, do you still believe that our armed forces are the best in the world? Well, yes, I do, actually. I mean, obviously, they're not the most powerful, because the most powerful nation in the world is obviously America. Just a week or so ago, we had the President of the United States of America here, President Donald Trump. And the sheer power and enormity of American wealth and firepower was here in a very soft way. But, you know, the convoy of cars in which he drives around in, snipers on the roof of the American embassy and all British buildings to where the president travelled. And all that, you know, is like what you might call internal security and all that. But we do know that the Americans have got something like 13 aircraft carriers, which are constantly circling the world and trying to, A, spot, you know, trouble where it comes, B, trying to suppress it, C, trying to keep the peace, D, trying to warn people don't mess with the West and all that kind of stuff, you know. So obviously they're the most powerful, and we know that. But the best can have a different definition, and the different definition is our application to our job of the military. Now, having lived down on the coast for the last 10 or 12 years, I've had a lot of contact with Royal Navy people. The new carrier, obviously, is berthed down there when it's in port. The Queen Elizabeth, named incidentally not after the current monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, but Queen Elizabeth I. Famous Queen Henry VIII's daughter. And you meet these people, you realise how good they are at their jobs and how professional they are. I mean, it's not that long ago, is it, since we were in action when we, you know, showed the world what we can do. And I'm talking really about the Falkland Islands, which was the 80s. I know we've been in other conflicts since then, but purely as an exercise, one against one, when we had to take on the Argentinians, that's what our forces did. And considering the whole battle was fought 7,000 or 8,000 miles away from home in the freezing waters of the South Atlantic off the back of two aircraft carriers, basically, OK, and a lot of support ships. And we took on a nation like Argentina, which is about, you know, the second or third biggest country in South America and about the eighth or ninth biggest country in the world. And we beat them. And we beat them because of the professionalism of our forces, Navy, obviously, who were the mainstay of the whole fleet, the soldiers they carried, the Army soldiers and the US and the Marines. I was going to say US Marines then. Excuse me. Who then had to go ashore and literally walk up to 60 miles to get to the battlefields and then take on the Argentinians who were there from, you know, their coastal divisions just a few hundred miles away. And we beat them. Not to forget, of course, the RAF, who weren't directly involved, but our pilots were off the back of the carriers. And the RAF played their part in many, many different ways, some which we don't even know about these days. But in terms of gathering intelligence on where Argentinian planes were and all that kind of stuff. So the answer is, yes, I hope so. I mean, I worry constantly that, you know, the defence budget is not being looked after and that we haven't got enough to do. We haven't got enough money to do what we want to do. You know, everybody talks about 2% of gross domestic product being put aside for the defence budget. I personally think it should be a bit more. We are an island state, and island states have to, you know, be particularly aware of the fact that they're vulnerable. I mean, obviously, the sea is a defence to us, but it can work both ways. That defensive barrier is millions of miles of square miles of sea, and it needs to be defended. So all I would say is that, yes, I do think we're the best, but we've got to be very, very, very careful that we keep it that way. Right, OK, folks, you're listening to Planet Porky. What you're listening to here is Ask Porky. Now, I've answered two or three questions in the first part of this podcast, and by the way, it's at Planet Porky. It's out every Tuesday and Thursday. I want your responses to it, and I've told you what that is. Get back to me. PlanetPorkyPod@gmail.com. Let's rattle through now a few more of these questions so I can respond to all of you who very kindly been in touch, OK? Now, I've got one here from Helen. How big a part of your life was Fleet Street, Porky? Well, look, let's answer that very quickly. It was a huge part of my life, wasn't it? I was actually in Fleet Street itself for about 12 years. Before that, I was on the Express in Manchester, which is kind of northern Fleet Street, for about another two or three, 15 years altogether. Before that, in newspapers. It was such a wonderful place to work and live. You'll have heard lots and lots of stories of Fleet Street in the past. So answer that straight question. How big a part of Fleet Street, how big a part of your life is Fleet Street? Enormous. And in a future podcast, by the way, delighted to be able to tell you that joining me will be a lady called Leslie Ann Jones, who was one of the great showbiz reporters of the you know, classic Fleet Street years, 70s, 80s, early 90s. And she'll have a few Fleet Street stories. Don't miss that. That's in an upcoming podcast. But there was nothing like it, really. I mean, I don't know how you explain it. If you're a doctor and you work in a huge hospital, then that is your life, isn't it? That's your background. Everything about your profession is there. So the smell of, you know, like, you know, medicines and that kind of stuff in a hospital, anaesthetic, I suppose, or something like that. The long hours you spend walking up and down corridors, going into operating theatres, visiting patients in wards and all that, you know, that becomes the backdrop to your life. If you're a fireman, the backdrop to your life is a fire station. And, you know, you go in there every day and those huge machines are standing there, those polished machines. It was a clean machine, said Paul McCartney in Penny Lane. You know, the fireman cleans his machine, it's a clean machine. And that's the backdrop to the life of a fireman. You know, if you, for instance, are a professional sportsman, you play football, you spend all your time in football grounds or on training pitches or on coaches going between football grounds or even these days, and has been for many years, aeroplanes flying between countries to play football. What I'm saying is everybody has an attachment to the environment in which they work, right? And that's one of the great things, I think, for everybody. If you have an environment which you love, in which you work, you are blessed in this country. I don't think when I grew up, some of my mates whose fathers worked in Vauxhalls at Ellesmere Port were attached to that sort of environment. I don't think that standing next to a what was called a production line every day and lifting a wheel and putting it on the, you know, on the wheel base, whatever you call it, you know, on the screws and then tightening the screws, doing that 16 times an hour for 8 hours on a shift was very fulfilling. And I don't think they'd go home at night and then sit there and couldn't wait to get back into the environment of working. They hated it. It was repetitive, an awful job. And that's one reason why, largely, there were so many strikes in the car industry. The work was repetitive and boring. So to answer the question about Fleet Street, huge part of my life, but work should be a huge part of everybody's life, because if you're in that environment and you like being there, you are very lucky. Right, let's move on. What have we got here? James says, Mike, how important is it to in life to have a laugh? Well, you know, that actually moves on a little bit from the last question about your working environment. Having a laugh is great, OK? And I don't think you should go through life without having a laugh, but you've got to laugh at the right moment and laugh at the right things. I mean, you know, what I'm trying to sort of say here is that you can't take life lightly, OK? Life's very tough. And I'm not, you know, playing a violin now and saying that, you know, you've got to battle through life. And if you're lucky enough to get into a great profession and you try to stay at the top of it, then you've got to be competitive, obviously. But a lot of situations in life can be eased by, you know, taking a excuse me, to the old air conditioning, by taking a lighter view of life. And for instance, by, you know, trying to turn a situation to your advantage by looking on the brighter side rather than the darker side, or addressing something in response, you know, or responding to something that's happened, I should say, by, you know, not laughing it off, but, you know, trying to lift yourself about it rather than to get down. So having a laugh is very important. I love having a laugh, but I have a laugh at the right time. I don't think you can always have a laugh in your working environment, because life can be terribly serious. Unless, of course, you're doing a show and you're meant to make people laugh, which I've always enjoyed doing. Love going up on the stage and maybe putting up a couple of videos of strange things that have happened and showing people, you know, something that's funny and getting a laugh. It's great to have a laugh. I mean, when you're on stage and you entertain people, it's great to have a laugh. But Having a laugh is one thing, you know, in the right time, but you can only have a laugh, I think, if the rest of your life is going well and it's in line and you've got a solid base to work from. Yes, having a laugh is important, but I'm suspicious of people who don't take life seriously enough, OK? Right, here we go. At the moment, part of the work I'm doing... Sorry, I'm telling you this now. I'm going to tell you what the question is now. Christine says, how much work does the makeup girl have to do for your TV appearances? Do you like yourself on TV? What a great question, Christine. Because recently I've been doing TV shows, which you may or may not have seen. If you haven't, you should get tuned in because I think they're great fun and love doing them with a lot of other guests who are great people. But it's called Jeremy Vine on Five, OK? Jeremy's a great guy. He's, you know, been a broadcaster for years. BBC man, I think, in TV. I think he might have worked in America as well. But perhaps known in more recent years as having a show on Radio 2 in the mornings. I think it's between 12 and 2. And it's lively and sparkling, plays great music. Jeremy, he's a graduate of Durham University. Very bright guy and, you know, asks the right questions and brings... talking about having a laugh in the last question, Jeremy's always ready for a laugh, always ready to raise your spirits and have a laugh and a shout. And I've enjoyed working with him on his radio show. And then he took over the mid-morning show on Channel 5, one that used to be hosted by a guy called Matthew Wright. Jeremy's taken it over. Really reinvigorated the whole thing and started inviting me to go and work. Well, not him. I mean him and the production company, you know, and it's ITN, actually. And I started doing that, really enjoyed it. It all seemed to be going well. And I do really enjoy it. And some of the people you meet are great. You know, I've met some great people there who I've never come across before. But the answer to the makeup girls there are absolutely wonderful, honestly. Now, you always make a joke about whether or not, you know, the Portmeister's got a face for radio or a face for TV. In my view, I've certainly got a face for radio. And I have to say, I don't particularly like looking at myself on TV. Now, everybody says, oh, well, you know, TV gives you an inch around your waist and half an inch around your chops and all that. I think it's worse than that, actually. In fact, I hope it's worse than that, because if not, then I'm not really as... Not the word I'm looking for. I'm not going to call myself ugly, but I'm not as actually... what's that expression? Something to the eye, not attractive to the eye. I'm maybe not as attractive to the eye as some of the people who appear on the show, but there are some very beautiful women who work on that show, and there are some young, you know, very good-looking guys. However, I believe I bring a wealth of experience to the show, you know, with my vast knowledge of world events and what I've done in the past and the experiences I've been through. Now, to answer directly the question about makeup, these girls are lovely. And what happens is, I will share a secret with you. Unfortunately, my hair, which is quite thick around the back and down the back of my head and that kind of stuff, is thinning on the top. But the problem I've got is that I'm losing hair more on the top, on the right side of the top of my head than the left side. So the girls now know that when I get in there, they sweep it Bobby Charlton style, you know, the sweep over. But it's not as long as that, obviously. I always get it cut, actually. The day before I'm doing telly, I always go and get my coiffeur in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, to trim my hair, even if I've only had it done the week before. Because hair that touches on your ears or on your collar on telly, I think looks awful. So anyway, so what the ladies do is they brush the hair from my left side to the right side across my head and make it look great. And they put like a bit of gel on it and all that. And then they spray it with that stuff that you spray on hair, you know, to keep it in place. And unfortunately, or not unfortunately, by the time the show's finished and the lights have been on it, it's kind of been baked into, you know, this like a helmet, really. And the first thing I do when I get home is have to wash it. The other things that I try and do is I try to get the ladies to sort of get their brush underneath my chin. so that they could possibly, by an optical illusion, remove the shadow of four of my five chins, right? And make myself look a bit more appealing, you know? The moment I look statuesque, I try to look appealing. And the third thing you have to do is, unfortunately, I've got a white blob on the end of my nose. And it's been diagnosed as a cancerous growth, but it's non-malignant. So it's not like I've got cancer, like threatening cancer. It needs removing. The problem is I haven't had time in the last few months to actually go and get it removed. I've had it diagnosed and I've had a biopsy in which they checked it out, which caused, you know, like me to have two stitches in the end of my nose. And it is definitely non-malignant. It doesn't seem to be spreading, but they've got a special powder to put in the end of my nose to get rid of that as well. So that's the answer to that one. They have to work very hard indeed, and they're great people. Let's answer just a couple more questions because you've been so good sending them in. I want to try and get through them all. Joyce says, do you believe you're still attractive to women? How could I possibly answer that, Joyce? Honestly, that's for somebody else to say. But, you know, yes, I think so. A lad called Gazza. It's not obviously Gazza as in Paul Gascoigne. Have you become a fan of gin drinking? It seems to be the in thing. And Mike, we know you're a metropolitan man. Well, Gazza, I've been drinking gin, I'm not joking, since I was about 18. I used to love a beautiful fizzing glass of gin and tonic, tumbled ice into it, straws to stir it around, bit of lemon or lime. And particularly in my days in New York, right, you know, you could have a few beers, but the beer's not, wasn't very good in America in those days. And so we used to go onto the Tanqueray and tonic, and you could have 20 of those a day, I'm not joking. I laid off the gin a long time ago because I was drinking it at such a rate, it probably contributed to my heart being knackered. But yes, I do love a gin and tonic, and I do occasionally still have one when I'm in the mood. Paul says, why are you obsessed by people's birthdays? Paul, I'm not. The thing is that the reason I like to bring up people's birthdays is because it signifies, you know, some sort of musical event. So the only birthdays I talk about on my radio shows, in these podcasts, sometimes on television, are, you know, like Keith Richards' birthday or, you know, Paul Weller's birthday or even like politicians' birthdays, because it'll bring up some event or some date. But it's always great to say, you know, I mean, for instance, quite recently, one of the Spice Girls had a birthday while they were on tour. Well, that's a great reason for celebration. Julia says, how's the feud going with Liam Gallagher? Well, I haven't really got a feud with Liam Gallagher. What happened was, Liam tweets out, he's got a million followers, he doesn't follow anybody himself. And on one occasion, I made a bit of a joke and said, you know, you've done awfully well for a pub singer. He then sent me a few vile responses because that's the way he talks, you know, quite a lot of bad language. I didn't take it personally. And recently, I sent him another little note about something. And believe me, it's all in good fun. Huge respect for Liam Gallagher because I do believe he's one of the great frontmen of rock and roll. You know, there have been plenty of others like Mick Jagger, obviously, and Freddie Mercury and Robert Plant and all that kind of stuff. But Gallagher, Liam Gallagher, up there with them. I can't understand why he never sang the lead in the signature tune for Oasis, Don't Look Back in Anger, which I understand was sung by Noel. And anyway, look, we've just time for one more, just very quickly. Porky, this comes from a guy called Billio. Has your blue silks theory worked recently in racing? This is because, folks, in any big race like the Epsom Derby, which was recently, but more usually the Grand National, the Cheltenham Gold Cup, I put each way money on the horses whose jockey is dressed in blue silks because I'm an Evertonian and I'm a blue. And on one occasion, one of the horses came in at 33-1. £10 each way, another 14 horses, £10 each way, one of which came fourth, and I made about £900. It's never worked since. So don't follow that theory, folks, unless you've got money to burn. I haven't got money to burn, but occasionally I like to put my money where my mouth is and the other way around. Listen, folks, you've been listening to Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed. The podcast, I want to hear from you all the time. It's planetporkypod@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Another one coming up very soon. I would use a bit of brain power, you and your mates, get together over a few beers one night, open a map of Europe, because quite honestly, I think it's not going to be a weekend if you've got to go much further than that, and find yourself somewhere nobody else has been before. And I mean that. There are great, great cities all over Europe, in France, in Spain, in Belgium, in Holland, obviously, in Scandinavia, and find yourself somewhere new. And then when you come back, with all the pictures you can take these days on your phones and all that, you will actually have something to tell somebody. And you'll have been somewhere that nobody else has been, OK? So that's my answer to that one. Rather long-winded, I'm sorry, but I am trying to help, OK? In my view, I've certainly got a face for radio, and I have to say, I don't particularly like looking at myself on TV. Now, everybody says, oh, well, you know, TV gives you an inch around your waist and half an inch around your chops and all that. I think it's worse than that, actually. In fact, I hope it's worse than that, because if not, then I'm not really as... What's the word I'm looking for? I'm not going to call myself ugly. Joyce says, do you believe you're still attractive to women? How could I possibly answer that, Joyce? Honestly, that's for somebody else to say. But, you know, yes, I think so.